8:13 now. Good morning. Well, it's National Trails Day tomorrow. On the phone to tell us more about that, I've got Charlie Sturgis with Mountain Trails. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. So Mountain Trails Day should be exciting. We are doing a new connection that's going off of Lowell Avenue up to Sweeney's. So tomorrow at 8 o'clock, we'll be meeting at the corner store up at the resort, Max Doherty's place, and he's going to be hosting coffee, and Wasatch Bagels will be hosting bagels at that point. And we'll walk up from there at 8:30 to the job site and get going to work. You know, it's a lot of wheat clipping and rock throwing and so forth tomorrow. So it'd be really good, and this will give us a chance to do the finish work on this trail and kind of maybe get it so it's actually open. So that should be exciting stuff. Also, just so folks know, this is not going to be a mud report today for the first time in a little while. We feel like trails are pretty good below mid-mountain. Even things like Armstrong, Ham, which still has a little bit of snow but is not necessarily muddy, look like they're in pretty good shape to go. So check our Facebook post. Have a great weekend. Looks like we're going to have a little bit of weather, but it should be pretty good riding. Things, you know, the go-tos like Round Valley and Riverview and Dutch Hollow and Corner Canyon should all be pretty good. So, Leslie, have a good weekend.
Okay, Charlie, thanks. Well, earlier this month, the Salt Lake Tribune announced it's pursuing federal approval to become a nonprofit operation. In the studio to tell us what that means for subscribers, I have editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the Tribune has seen some hard times. That after being drained of resources and assets by the New York hedge fund owner, struggling through a joint operating agreement with Deseret News, the layoff, of course, of staff a year ago. After all that, how did publisher Paul Huntsman land on this nonprofit option?
You know, it's actually something he's explored since he bought the paper back in 2016. He wasn't quite convinced that the market wouldn't turn around and life in journalism would be more stable. Unfortunately, that is not the case. The Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that two of the major players, Gatehouse and Gannett, are considering a merger. And local news is the sufferer. You know, that is the institution that really is taking the hit. And so we started poking around at a nonprofit model pretty seriously about a year ago, and here we are.
Yeah. Now, when you were brought on as editor, I recall it was to help the Trib have a better online presence, digital experience. Have you done that to the extent that you need to?
Yeah, well, you know, digital is always changing. One of the first things that we did was to revamp our website and our apps and update them. It's time to do it again. You know, it's been 2.5 years. Paul has sunk hundreds of thousands of dollars into the digital presence because the fact is that's where our audience has migrated. And, you know, young people today don't pick up the hard copy as much as us older folks. And so I think the smart money is going to be on digital going forward. However, we want print to live on for as long as it can.
Yeah. So this would be funded then through what? An endowment? I mean, what is it? I know that you've brought on Community Foundation of Utah founder Fraser Nelson as the vice president of business innovation. So she's trying to build that endowment?
That's right. So there are actually two pieces to it. One is an endowment, the Utah Journalism Foundation. We've already gotten our EIN from the IRS on that. So that is moving forward. And it's a pretty straightforward nonprofit. Other legacy newspapers have done this model where they've created this umbrella that will fund journalism projects, including the Salt Lake Tribune, for a very long time. So building up that endowment is essential. The new piece, the sort of innovative piece, is transforming the Salt Lake Tribune itself into a 501c3. And a legacy newspaper has not done that before. So that's the experimental part. And Paul thinks that's really necessary to sustain the newspaper in the long run. Like, you know, we've had advertising, print advertising, and subscriptions really bolster. That's been the business model for legacy newspapers for decades. It's not working. It's broken. And so we need a third leg to that stool. And we think philanthropy is that key.
Well, you have a background in public radio, and
which is
a community-funded news model. And for those who may remember, you and I used to spend mornings together when KPCW and KCPW were stationed there at the Marsac
That's
building
right.
many years ago. Should this nonprofit status, though, be approved by the IRS? I mean, how will the future of the Trib be any different than public radio?
It'll be different in that we want the print element to stay there at some point. The complicating factor, as you mentioned, is the JOA. We have this joint operating contract with the Deseret News for our printing presses. That is set to expire at the end of 2020. And so that kind of infuses some question marks into this whole equation. You know, what will our business relationship, if any, look like going forward? So those are the questions I think that we'll get back from the IRS. We're actually filing with the IRS today on the Tribune side. And because it is the first, we expect some questions to come back from them. But as you mentioned, nonprofit news is not new. Public radio has been in that business for a very, very long time. We have a lot of online digital nonprofit news organizations that have worked just fine. It's just the print piece that's a little bit complicated, but we're going to figure it out.
Yeah. So will there continue to be a print outlet? You just don't know until after 2020?
You know, Paul has said market will help dictate that. As long as it makes financial sense for us to do it, we absolutely want to do it because that is a core part of our audience. We love our print readers and subscribers, and we want to provide that product for as long as it's feasible.
Yeah. So back to this notion of a community-funded news model. I mean, so are there going to be, like, public radio, Tribune pledge drives?
I don't know if there would be pledge drives. We're certainly going to be creative on the fundraising side. It's funny, you know, when I became editor in 2016, a lot of people said, we want the Tribune to survive. We want you to thrive. What can we do besides subscribe? And I said, nothing. You know, there's really no mechanism for you to help us out. Now, as a nonprofit, there will be other avenues for people. So if you have, you know, a foundation, we'll take your money. If you want to subscribe and give a little bit more, that's okay. So I think it'll just open up a lot of different fundraising doors for us. I don't know. Fund drive? you know, I love the fund drive, and I think it's a great way to get the message out. But we are print, so we'll see.
And that's the difference, I think. You know, with public radio, our listeners have unlimited access
that's absolutely
to,
right.
to everything that, mm-hmm. even if they don't contribute.
Right.
Your model will be, it will remain a subscriber service?
Kind of. Right now, you have to hit a paywall. So you get a limited number of free articles every month. We just struck an agreement with the Salt Lake City Library System. So there will be free access to anyone in any of the city libraries. And we've had some interest from other libraries around the state. So there will be avenues for free access. However, we do need to sustain, you know, a high-level newsroom with a lot of reporters. That's our mission. And so that is why we think that the subscription model will continue to work for us.
Yeah. And then when you look at, I mean, some of the long-time subscribers, I mean, I've been a newspaper subscriber for 30 years, right?
Thank you, Leslie Thatcher.
But the thing is that it's my husband who reads the paper anymore. I mean,
yeah.
I'll read it here at work. But to pay for both, I mean, is that what's, because that's what I have to do now. I mean, if I want the digital online, I have to pay an extra, you know, $1.99 or something a month.
Yeah, yeah. So we will have different levels of giving, as you do in public radio. And I think that really what it comes down to, you pay for what you get. You know, there's a quality element to it, and you pay for the experience that you want. If you want that digital 24-hour-a-day access, that's great. If you want the print delivered on your doorstep every morning, that's great, too. But it's a different kind of experience, and so we think that consumers will respond to that.
Yeah. I mean, as you're kind of looking ahead, I mean, in terms of just the coverage then that you start to provide, if it was digital only, I mean, would we still have the Pulitzer Prize investigations that, that you know, earn the papers such accolades?
I absolutely guarantee it. Our mission will not change with this business model transition. The fact is, the vast majority of our readers are online, like to the tune of millions per month versus tens of thousands in the print. And so I just think that our journalism has not taken a hit by transitioning to a digital model.
Yeah, but there's now that immediacy, right, of being first.
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, there's pressure to do faster, and that doesn't mean we're not going to go deep. I think that our investigations have been fantastic this year. And the year before that, and the year before that. So I do think that there is a legacy of in-depth reporting that's not going to go away.
Yeah. And in terms of the number of staff members, I mean, mm-hmm. Do you think this is going to be able to bring you back to where you were?
We absolutely anticipate adding to the newsroom. That's the goal. Paul Huntsman bought this paper not as a vanity project. He really wanted to sustain local voices in Utah and to continue the I don't want to say it's only aggressive reporting, but the hard-hitting reporting that is needed to keep the checks and balances on government and large institutional powers in place. So I think that, the vision is to build on that. And as a for-profit company, he didn't see a way that was going to happen. Again, when you look at the media landscape, it's pretty bleak in print media right now. You've got a lot of mergers going on. And what that means is, quote unquote, efficiencies, and efficiencies mean less people and less reporters, and that's not acceptable. And so as he was trying to figure out a way to make a long-term sustainable organization, he just thought, we've got to do something different.
Yeah. What kind of impact would being a community-funded organization have on the Tribune's editorial arm? I mean, do you have the freedom then to endorse political candidates? Does Pat Bagley get to push boundaries?
Pat is not going anywhere as long as I'm here. I think that that's a common fear. Oh my goodness, now you're going to be accountable to a board. Well, right now, in a lot of ways, we're accountable to one person having a diffusion of power. Actually, it is probably better in a lot of ways. We've longstanding had a relationship with our advertising community and built up a very firm firewall between advertisers and the newsroom. So there's really no mixing there. We're going to build the same firewall between interests on our boards and the newsroom. The newsroom will be as insulated as it is now. My job is to protect them from any outside influence and allow them to do the hard-hitting reporting that's our mission. And so I think that there are fears that come with this untested territory, but Leslie, as you know, you're a news person in a nonprofit newsroom, and you can function without interference. I think that we will be able to as well.
Yeah. So you do see yourself as endorsing political candidates?
No, that will actually go away as part of the 501c3 application. And that's, I think, why this model may work for other communities, but may not, because local newspaper publishers, that's just been part and parcel of their purchase. When Paul bought the paper, that was part of the asset. You know, you get to control the editorial page, and you do get to do those editorial endorsements. That kind of speech is not allowed under 501c3. We can still do editorial opinions as an educational, but we can't specifically endorse candidates. And that will be the main difference on the editorial page.
Okay. And again, back to this joint operating agreement, it expires next year, 2020. Mm-hmm. Does that mean it's up for renegotiation, or is it just means that you don't have access to the printing presses anymore.
It is being renegotiated now, and I can't really speak to that because that's not public yet. But, yeah, with the expiration, we don't know exactly what that transition is going to look like. So stay tuned.
You have done some surveying, I know, of subscribers. Anything you can tell us about what you're hearing at this point?
The survey has had tremendous response. We surveyed about 40,000 people. It's the period is still ongoing until next week. And so I can't say with certainty what we've had about 4,000 respondents so far, which is a tremendous response, overwhelmingly positive. But we're going to go dig into the data as soon as that survey period is concluded next week.
Yeah, certainly your competition is all news agencies.
Absolutely.
But I mean, it's the D-News. I mean, I think you guys have your own niches. But do you see yourself now becoming more competitive with the KUERs and the KPCWs and you know, those?
It's always been a crowded market here. and I think more voices is more better. I mean, I think we need multiple access points to what's happening in our communities. I think competition is good for all of us. And that is really the worry when a newspaper shutters or a TV station is, you know, subsumed by some corporate conglomerate. You lose local connection. You lose more local voices and they become more corporatized. I think that, you know, the Tribune, that is why the Tribune has such a great place in this state, is that it is one of many voices. Traditionally, it's had a lot of deep reporting that some news organizations can't do. And so we think that that is a unique place. We don't want to lose it. We're going to do everything we can to keep it strong for decades to come.
Yeah. And then when you think about the Monday morning paper, about just how skimpy it's become, we're not talking about, you're still talking about now 24/7 as opposed to Monday through Sunday.
Absolutely.
Huh?
And that, again, you know, people say, oh, the newspaper keeps shrinking. But the news content has not shrunk all that much. I mean, we're still publishing a lot of stories online. Most of them, well, I wouldn't say most, but a large percentage of our coverage doesn't make it into print anymore because it's too expensive to print it. But it is available online. So if you go to sltrib.com, you'll see all of our news stories there.
Okay. Well, a real exciting time. I guess a bit scary too, huh?
A little nerve-wracking. Uncharted territory always is. But, you know, we've had tremendous support from the community so far. A lot of positive comments. A lot of phone calls and emails saying, hey, how do I get on your board? So I take that as a very good sign. People are very invested in the Tribune, and we want to you know, grasp that enthusiasm. And as soon as we get the IRS approvals, we'll start asking for some support.
Okay. Jennifer, appreciate the drive up.
Thanks, Leslie.
Jennifer Napier-Pierce, the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Council had two meetings this week to discuss the 2019 Sundance Film Festival, the budget, and more. Joining me with a recap, I have Council Member Tim Henney. Good morning, Tim.
Morning, Leslie. Felt like five meetings.
Yeah, I bet it did. let's see. You had asked that a request to authorize $60,000 for the Summit County Mental Health Director position be pulled off of the consent agenda for more discussion. Because this is a full-time position, not a contracted position, why is Park City being asked to put money towards this salary for a Summit County employee?
Well, I think that's part of what we want to discuss. When it was a contract position, there was not really an issue. We were contributing to something that is important to the regional, a regional issue that we wanted to participate in. So, but that's different, you know, a contract position versus an employee, full-time employee position with benefits. There is a difference there, and we have not had the ability to have that conversation. So this is really about process and something that things that are on the consent agenda, by and large, we have seen and talked about in previous meetings, whether it's study sessions or work sessions or in public meetings. So by the time it gets to the consent agenda, we feel like we have done that process and that due diligence, and it's been deliberative, so we can make a decision. This one, I felt, me personally as a council member, I didn't feel like I was informed enough to make that decision. And that was really the feeling amongst the other council members as well. It was pretty unanimous.
All right, let's see. This week's budget hearing centered on operational expenses and fees. Seems that there are a lot of new positions opening up in transit, the police department. And I guess the question was, are we using the people we already have in the right way?
Yeah, our full-time employees have grown a fair amount, and I think this is, again, something that we want to do a deeper dive in. So we will be doing that. We'll be doing that in the mid-year retreat. It'll probably be one of the primary topics. And this, of course, relates and plays into the overall budget, how we're allocating funds. But, it's when you're police department, which we think is not overstaffed, and by looking at the requests that are made, you could argue that it's dramatically understaffed, because each of these departments requests that are made far outweigh what we actually allocate to them. So it's a matter of trying to find that sweet spot of optimizing and being efficient with the people that we have, not overstaffing, not understaffing. And that's what we're striving for. So, that's what this budgeting process is all about. And that's why it takes many weeks. And that's why staff works on it for, probably half a year before they come to us with a proposal.
Yeah. So is it a matter of maybe looking at all of the various teams or departments and seeing and maybe doing some reorganization like we've done with the transit and public utilities departments?
That was mentioned in public comment that we might want to do that. But so we have two employees, the city manager and the city attorney, that report directly to council. And there's also some hesitation on our part to micromanage what each of those employees are doing. They are responsible for their departments. And when you say departments with the city manager, Diane Foster, she's the admin and exec branch of the government. And the way that we have it set up, she is responsible for many teams and many departments and oversees how that functions. So she's really in charge of the mousetrap, and whether that mousetrap is effective or not as effective as it might be, and optimizing the effectiveness is really what she is tasked with. So, we review her every year. We review Mark Harrington in the legal department every year. That's kind of how we get to it. It is a top-down process versus a bottom-up. For me, one of the key ingredients is when people leave, that represents an opportunity to up-level every position. And through the years with Toby Ross, then Tom Backley, and now Diane Foster, there's been an up-leveling that has occurred, and that's been in response to the complexity of the issues that we face here in this community.
You heard from Angela Mosqueda, who gave you input on how not understandable and clear the budget reports are for the public. She says that the agendas are not navigable and information is missing. The city should consider hiring someone to make the communications around the budget more clear. Is that something you agree with, or something you're interested in?
Well, I do agree that we can always do a better job of conveying a more concise and clear message, and I think that talking about it in terms of the budget is that may be one of the more difficult pieces to tackle, but we can always do a better job of being clear and helping people understand what it is we're trying to accomplish on their behalf. And we can hear what's being asked of us from the community. We can do a better job of hearing. We can do a better job of distilling. And we can do a better job of reflecting back. Again, I think we've made significant progress in the last 5 years since I've been on council with that aspect. But I'll tell you, I look at, a more simple way to look at it for me is our website. I'm not great with websites in general. But, boy, I find our website, I would have a hard time calling it user-friendly.
On Wednesday, the council received an update from the Central Wasatch Commission. Councilmember Joyce wants to know why we need to be involved in the group paying money when it's mostly related to transportation in Big and Little Cottonwood Canyons. What about you? I mean, do you think it benefits Park City to be part of this?
Well, I heard Steve say that there's a benefit to being part of it, and it's a matter of how much we pay to be part of it. And I've listened to your interviews with the county council as well, and I'm hearing that consistently from both of our organizations and our councils. And I think that's the question. That's what we're going to be looking at. You know, and every time, I mean, we have two communities back here who are contributing. You know, the county's putting in $50,000 a year. Park City's putting in $100,000 a year. Every time the county puts in $50,000, half of that comes from inside Park City limits. So that $50,000 is really $25,000 from not non-Park City residents and $25,000 from Park City limit residents. And then Park City residents are putting in another $100,000. So the way I look at it, and I think the way Steve looks at it, and I think the way other council members look at it in Park City, is we're putting in $125,000. Now, we do want to participate. We do see value. We do recognize that we have already received value. But it's a matter of how much and the relative contributions from other entities that are putting in also. Alta's putting in $15,000. Alta's right in the heart of this whole thing. They're a tiny community. I get that. Their tax base is much smaller than ours. But there's got to be some rationale for the relative contributions and how they're balanced. And that's what we'll be talking about and looking at.
Residents expressed concerns during the Sundance 2019 debrief about the traffic from the share rider vehicles in the neighborhoods. Is it even possible to reroute GPS for Lyft and Uber to keep them out of the neighbors?
Well, you know, I've heard different things. If you talk to Lyft and Uber representatives, you will get a fairly vague response about how that's very difficult to do. When you talk to transportation experts who have a broader picture and see what's happening in other municipalities across the country, there are places that have put very stringent and rigorous restrictions on where these companies can go. And I believe the term is geofencing. And it works, and they are prohibited from certain districts or areas or neighborhoods or streets. I think we're going to go there, but you have to really draw it out of them that that is something that they are capable of doing. They definitely, it's not their first choice, obviously.
So if somebody wanted to be picked up by Lyft at the top of Park Avenue, would they have to just then walk somewhere?
Yeah, that's how it's done. You have pickup and drop off zones, and your passenger is told on their app that they will have to navigate their way to the pickup zone. So it's not, you know, the car coming to where you are, which is the normal, that's the preferred model from their standpoint. The preferred model from our standpoint is creating some structure to this chaotic system.
Okay. I think you've got some public comment regarding food trucks. Did that ever happen, putting food trucks out at the Bob Wells Plaza?
Yeah, and I think it's just a lack of understanding of what we've done. But we do, my understanding is we do allow for food trucks, and I heard the mayor say, you know, on private property, and there are time limits and you know, hours of operation and amount of time that you can be open to. I think if you are below a certain threshold, you don't even have to be, you don't have to go through any city process. If you're above a certain number of hours threshold, then you do. But it's already available. It could happen. So I think we just need to figure that one out. And again, this goes back to our first conversation about being clear and understanding, be able to convey the information in a way that most people or more people or as many people as is possible to get the information to in a clear way, at which I just didn't do. I mean, obviously, there's some need for us to revisit this and be able to message it a little bit more clearly.
I'm just not up late enough to know.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, I get it. You know, people coming out of the bars at 2 or 3 in the evening and finding a quick place to grab a bite before they go home kind of makes sense. On the other hand, I think, you know, to use the no name as an example, I don't know when they stop serving food, but I think they're serving until 2 o'clock you know, when they shut the doors anyway. So there's a little bit of a rub between food trucks and brick and mortar establishments that might be meeting that need already.
Okay, Tim, hey, thanks for your time.
You bet, Leslie.
Park City Council member Tim Henney. It's 8:45 now. Good morning. Well, on Sunday, the Park City Sunday Market opens for its 13th season. In the studio, I have Executive Director of the Market, Kate McChesney. Good morning.
Good morning.
So same drill as every other year, every Sunday, except for Arts
Three
Festival.
In August.
Three in August.
Yeah, so the three in August. Arts Festival, and then there's the No Event Weekend, and then the tour. So the tour actually moved. So the 4th is Arts, the 11th is No Event Weekend, and then the 18th is the Tour of Utah.
Okay. So is that good for you and your staff? Or?
Oh, God, yeah.
Get a summer vacation?
We get a little, so kind of. Our staff also moves out to the Summit County Fair, and so we'll do that those two particular weekends. And then as well, the rumor kind of is out there, but the Park City Sunday Market starting a new market up in Spokane, Washington, called the Quest Sunday Fest. And that's also going to be on Sundays. It'll be interesting to see, but we're super excited, and it's really hitting it, so we're excited.
Yeah, and that was, I know you started a similar market in Oakley a couple of years ago. You had mentioned that there might be something happening in Heber. Is the Washington one the only one that's actually kind of...
The Washington one, right. So we've done consulting. Obviously, we did start the Oakley market, and then the new mayor kind of put the kibosh on it, didn't really see any economic impact, and that's okay. And then in Heber, we did some consulting, and then they had some transitioning out there. But it's always nice. You know, we always give them kind of the recipe of success, and then we walk away and say, hey, look, there are some of the things that we've tried to incorporate. We see that making it happen. But absolutely, Washington is the one that's really taking off, and we're super excited about that. So it's going to be 5 Sundays this summer.
Yeah, like Sundance just put out this week their economic impact report. Do you guys do something like that as well?
We do kind of an economic impact report. We don't have the $40,000 to pull one of those off every year. We'd love to, but I can tell you that in 2017, we did over $165,000 in sales tax. So if you kind of incorporate that, our vendors over the course of 14 Sundays do well over $1 million. So we're doing something for the community. And 15,000 people showing up on a Sunday, I would hope to think that there's a really good economic impact. So we kind of look at really the just what we can see and visualize on a Sunday. And when we do get the $40,000 to pull one of those, absolutely, I would love to do that.
Yeah. And again, so hours, I mean, similar to years past?
Similar to years past, absolutely. 10 to 5. And then that last one where the entire community comes out, it'll be 10 to 6. And that's just really also giving our vendors an opportunity to come down and see what happens when they're not on the street all day long. And I think it really is the, you know, we kick off this weekend, which I have a feeling we're going to be absolutely packed because the community has been waiting and chomping at the bit to just get outside. The weather looks amazing. So I know biking is going to be super important for everybody. And we're going to have a place for you to come and listen to live music. The bar will be up and running and our bike valet as well in the Town Lift Plaza.
Okay, and you're also still going to kind of do your weekly themes? Is that?
We're going to do our weekly themes. This weekend, we're really kicking off with the Rainbow of Pride. Because, of course, we coincide with the Pride Festival. So wear your flag and get all colorful. And I know sometimes Salt Lake can be a little crazy as well. So it's nice to just kind of stay up here, but we could still celebrate.
Okay. I know you also still provide free space to nonprofits. That registration has kind of come and gone.
That registration has come and gone. Unfortunately, I would love to say that we have room for more, but we cap out. And that's even with 3 to 5 a week. And so at 14 of those have capped out. We're always still looking for volunteers. If I didn't say that, Beth Bratkin would probably kick me in the shin on Sunday. So volunteers. Competing with 130 other nonprofits in this town is difficult when everybody does want to volunteer, but it's just finding the right place for them. So our volunteers are seated. They're in the shade. There's no laborious lifting. If they have their tip certification, they can hang out by the bar and check everybody's IDs while they listen to music. Otherwise, they're just clicking everybody walking in the door and saying hello and answering questions. Where do I go get breakfast? Where can I go get lunch? How do I get out of here? Where's the farmer's market?
If someone's interested in volunteering, just send an email.
Absolutely. They can send an email to kate@parksillysundaymarket.com or info. Any one of the numbers on our website will direct you. Also, there's a link on our on our Facebook page and our web page.
Okay. And so. Farmers Market, again, at the post office?
Yes, Farmers Market, absolutely. So we've got 22 great farmers and gourmet foods coming. There's also live music happening there. And that's really convenient because there is some parking up here where if you're really only interested in getting your breads and gourmet foods and vegetables and fruits, you can park in the 15 to 30 minute parking right here. Walk in, walk out, be on your way.
Have you figured out the parking there on Lower Main or Lower Park Avenue? I know that that's been a concern for residents, just them not having a spot to park.
Yes. So between us and the city, we get signage out there. And as well, the city has been knocking on doors and giving everybody the event schedule for the entire summer and just kind of saying, here's what's going to happen. But we've been blocking off that street now for, I think, 3 years so that the residents of Lower Main or Lower, like you said, Lower Park Avenue can get in and out of their driveway. So we've done our darndest.
And then, good, music is a big part of it. That promote each of them online each week?
Or? Exactly, mm-hmm. Yes. You can see our event schedule on our webpage or there's an email that goes out. If you're not actively getting our emails, you can sign up for them. And then our Facebook page as well does the event schedule. And it's done through Mountain Town Music. So he also is launching his weekly musical festivals. And so we're listed on there. The ones that aren't, that kind of do come through is we have a ton of buskers, lots of kid buskers. They're awesome. They play the viola, they play the bucket drums, they play guitar. Super talented children that are coming up on Main. One of our children who we're super excited to always talk about is Michael McNamara. He plays the violin. I found him one day. He was playing over at Best Buy, and I didn't have any money, right? No, we're such a cashless society. So I threw my business card in there, and I told him to call. So his mom called, and that was 3 years ago, and now he's playing for the Utah Symphony Orchestra. He's 14. Right? Right? Yes, we are making things happen. So excited. The businesses that launch, and then on top of that, now we've got children that are starting to live their dreams. So it gives me goosebumps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kids Garden back as well.
Kids Garden is back as well, exactly. So all the kids, we have bounce houses, face painting, we have balloon tying coming this weekend, as well as a mechanical bull, the rock climbing wall, which is all conveniently located right next to the bar.
Hmm.
So, There's some strategy.
Yeah, and I know that I think your biggest market of the year is usually around the July 4th weekend.
Yes, that's going to be a big weekend. So, of course, we now also program the 4th of July. So we didn't have anything else to do. So we're going to program the 4th of July. That's going to be a great weekend. That'll happen on Thursday. And then as well, right, that Sunday, we should expect to have quite a few thousand people, that's for sure. And we'll have buses running from the high school, and we'll have some additional buses running from Park City Mountain Resort. And then as well, I think we're going to look into capitalizing on some of the other schools and seeing what we can do from there. And then the 10-minute commuter from Ecker as well. Or not. Yeah, Ecker. Ecker will be running. Yeah.
Okay.
So the transportation's there. Please use it.
Okay. Anything else, Kate, you wanted to mention?
Oh, gosh. No, Leslie, I love seeing you. Thank you so much for inviting us. We always appreciate being on KPCW.
Okay. Kate, thanks.
Thanks.
Kate McChesney is the executive director of the Park City Sunday Market. Again, it opens at 10 a.m. on Sunday. PCW News Time now, 8:53. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Summit Community Gardens has a new director and a number of upcoming events in the studio. Joins me now, Coley Cooley. I'm going to say it again.
Coley Ballou. Yes.
Coley Ballou.
Short for Nicole.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about yourself and why you wanted this job.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I've been, I'm originally from the Pacific Northwest, a little island called Bainbridge Island up in Washington. And on Bainbridge, you're at sea level, you have great temperature and lots of rain, and so you can grow pretty much anything. I remember when I was about 3 years old planting the garden with my mom on Bainbridge, peas and corn and lettuces, and just instilled a love of gardening and growing things. Spent some time in Oregon for college, about 10 years. Moved out here 5 years ago, and moving out here quickly realized how different it is to grow up at high altitude and in an arid desert. So I actually worked at Park City Nursery for a number of years and Copper Moose Farms, and was able to get my foundation of high altitude practices and actually feel I can take a lot more pride and have a lot more respect for growing things up in elevation. So last year, December, January, position opened up. Lindsay Gaiman, my predecessor, had been with the community gardens since the get-go, since the start. And I was offered the job and definitely accepted it with enthusiasm, excitement.
Great, great. So is it a full-time job year-round?
Almost, mostly. In the winter time, a lot to do with planning, which I'm really excited that I had the opportunity to start in January. So I had these months of preparation. And then, of course, now the season is really turning on as far as in the gardens and out in the community.
Okay. Again, the gardens are located out there by Matt Canute Park off of Highway 224. And are all your plots taken and spoke for?
They are, yeah. So we are 1.5 acre of community garden space. We're enclosed, so keeping deers and moose out is very helpful. And yes, we have 88 community plots currently, which we actually have a pretty big wait list this year, which is good and bad. We'll be doing a expansion this year. So we're going to add 40 additional plots. So those will be available for next year. We're excited to offer that. We also have 3 perennial demonstration gardens, Firewise, Pollinator, and Sensory. And then we have 4 annual vegetable and flower demonstration gardens, which serve as great educational pieces, not only for adult education classes and kids' summer camps, but also for our community plot renters. We try to really show the most successful way to grow at high altitude. So, and anyone's welcome in the community to always come and see our practices and see how they can use those the best they can. And then we have a weekly farmers market in the summer in which we'll sell our produce. So that'll be Wednesday from 9 to 11. And we also are able to donate food from our demonstration gardens to local food banks, including CCPC. Last year, we were able to donate over 1,000 pounds just to CCPC alone. So hoping to donate even more this year.
Okay. Tell me a little about, you've got an upcoming fundraiser, the Spring Fundraiser. When and where is that?
Absolutely. It's our Seeds of Change fundraiser, annual fundraiser. It's our 3rd annual one this year. It's going to be on Sunday, June 2nd, so this coming Sunday from 4 to 7 p.m. at Myrtle Rose in New Park. Looks like the weather's going to be wonderful, which is fantastic because we have both indoor and outdoor space. We'll have live music with Alicia Stockman, a local singer and songwriter, one of our favorites. She's been at our events before. We're really excited to have her. It'll be a pizza buffet, Myrtle Rose signature appetizers and drinks. And then really exciting for our opportunity drawing and silent auctions, in which we have some great wellness packages, including nutrition sessions and gift certificate to Good Movement Pilates Studio, Spectrum Salon, Land Juicery. We have kids activity packages with free kids summer camps to our budding scientists, Cycles, and a week in the life of a farmer. And then the PC Ice Arena also. And then we're offering from the gardens small private group flower arranging for up to 6 people. We're offering composter and compost consultation. We're also offering garden consultation in your home, private yoga, pizza party and drinks for 20 at the corner store. Lots of cool gift certificates out at local eateries like Hearth and Hill and Park City Mountain Resort. So some really cool prizes.
Okay, the cost of the tickets then?
So $45 for a single ticket, $75 for bringing a friend, $95 is our HOP supporter, and then $250 for our VIP.
All right, and do people need to RSVP before Sunday?
That would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. We have tickets available on our website, summitcommunitygardens.org, under our Gather tab.
Okay. You also have some fun summer camps for kids coming up?
We do, yeah. Starting at the last week of June is our Cycles Camp, a partner camp with Recycle Utah. Goes Monday through Thursday, so the 24th through the 28th. Really exciting, different adventure every single day. We still have spots available in that camp. We're also partnering with Eats and Swanner and then doing some of our own summer camps. The Eats and Swanner camps are sold out, unfortunately, but we still have availability in the other summer camps, so you can find more information of that on our website as well.
Okay, and then you also have adult education class.
We do. We've really ramped up our adult education classes this year. This is one of my main goals when I first started. So we're offering education classes all year round, paralleling the growing season. So it's about 1 to 2 classes per month. We've been partnering with Park City Nursery, doing some classes there. We offer them sometimes at the Summit Community Gardens as well, now that the weather is nice. Some really great material. And as I said, I'm a transplant from sea level and quite different growing practices. And so it's really important to me. I'm really passionate about educating our community, a lot of people who have come from elsewhere, on the best ways to garden up here to have the most success.
Okay. All of that, again, online.
Online, correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Anything else you wanted to mention?
One more. So back-to-back weekends, this weekend, Seeds of Change. And then the following weekend, we have our native plant sale, which we're partnering also with Park City Nursery. On Saturday, that will be from 9 to noon. And on Sunday, that will be from 10 to 1. So some really great native plants like the blue flax, Oregon grape, rabbit brush, artemisia will be available. On Sunday, we have, it's our second Sunday events, which we're really ramping up this year as well. Yoga in the morning from 8 to 9 a.m. And then something called Coffee Talks, which is free to the public. Hugo Coffee is sponsoring this with fresh coffee, and we'll have a local professional speak. This week it will be June 9th will be Inza Riepen, and she'll be speaking more in depth on native plants in particular, which will complement the native plant sale quite well. But the main activity is 4 to 7 p.m. Live music and kids' activities is 4 to 5 p.m. And then live music will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Morgan and McCoon. Yeah, we invite people to come out and bring a picnic and enjoy.
Okay. Hey, thanks for your time.